As clinicians, we are often faced with questions from families about the, quote, best, unquote, program for autism intervention. While children with autism may receive a range of services, including speech and language therapy, occupational therapy, and social skills help, the anchor to most programs is some form of behavioral health treatment. The latest issue of the Carlatt Child Psychiatry Report includes an interview with Dr. Michael Sandbank, who's an assistant professor of special education at the University of Texas, Austin. Dr. Sandbank specializes in early childhood special education, and she and her colleagues published a systematic review and meta-analysis that has taken the autism research community by storm. In this podcast, Mara and I will discuss Dr. Sandbank's research and the three main approaches to autism intervention. Welcome to the Carlatt Psychiatry Podcast. This is a special episode from the Child Psychiatry team. I'm Dr. Josh Fader, the editor-in-chief of the Carlatt Child Psychiatry Report and co-author of the Child Medication Factbook for Psychiatric Practice.
And I'm Mara Goverman, a licensed clinical social worker in Southern California with a private practice. And I'm also a regional director at Positive Development Institute. So before we dive into our interview with Dr. Sandbank, let's take a few minutes briefly to summarize the three main intervention approaches for young children with autism.
In the past couple of decades, the field of autism intervention has evolved into three main evidence-based approaches: traditional applied behavioral analysis, ABA, developmental relationship-based intervention, DRBI, and naturalistic developmental behavioral intervention, NDBI. ABA is the best known type of intervention. It's based on operant learning theory, meaning that the behavior is learned based on what happens before the behavior, an antecedent, and what happens after it, the reward. Some drawbacks of the ABA approach include poor maintenance of skills, poor generalization of learning to new situations, and reliance on adults to inform children what to do, otherwise known as prompt dependency.
In contrast to behavioral intervention, DRBI is a parent-mediated intervention, PMI, where the primary focus is on supporting parents and other caregivers to build and use warm, meaningful interactions to help the child to function better in communicating, learning, and problem solving. The strategies of developmental interventions are distinct from behavioral intervention approaches in that they use free play without direct didactic instruction or contingent rewards. An adult takes a child's interest and builds on it while making the activity an emotionally meaningful experience. The best known model is the DIR floor time, or simply floor time.
In an effort to address some of the drawbacks of traditional ABA, the third approach to autism intervention, NDBI, incorporates more choices for children to gain their buy-in to treatment. The learning is carried out in natural situations such as play or daily routines and involves parents, and the rewards are given related to the child's interest. The goals are still more discreet, like with ABA, but the choices make for more naturalistic learning.
Over the past decade or so, the standards for study designs in autism research have changed dramatically.
For instance, in the early 2000s, high-quality randomized controlled trials were practically non-existent in the field of autism research. And in 2011, a systematic review from Pediatrics revealed that out of all the studies they identified that investigated early interventions for young children with autism, only two were considered high-quality randomized controlled trials.
A similar systematic review from 2017 set out to quantify the amount of randomized controlled trials in the field of early autism intervention research. They found a total of 48 randomized controlled trials. So we do see this upward trend of randomized controlled trials becoming the standard study design within the field.
This field is rapidly expanding, and the rate at which new evidence has emerged is astounding. This tidal wave of new autism research inspired Dr. Sandbank and her colleagues to perform a systematic review and meta-analysis of these studies.
They used a recently developed technique that let them compare all the effect sizes for different outcome measures across many different studies. Researchers often declare that a treatment works if it has a statistically significant benefit over placebo. Statistically significance gives some confidence that there is a treatment effect, but it's not the final word on treatment efficacy. What we really want to know is the effect size, the magnitude of the treatment effect. Common convention is that 0.2 equals small, 0.5 equals medium, and 0.8 equals large. In psychiatry, effective treatments nearly always generate small to medium effects compared to placebo. It is now standard practice to report effect size in treatment studies. A study that fails to report effect size may be hiding a minimal treatment benefit.
Dr. Sandbank and her team summarized numerous studies on ABA, developmental interventions, and naturalistic developmental behavioral interventions, and they compared the efficacies of these interventions to one another. Her study really sheds light on the quality of many studies examining early interventions for youth with autism.
So kind of right off the bat, we wanted to you know, just look at everything and kind of put it in these boxes of, you know, what kind of intervention is this? What kind of outcomes are they studying? And usually there were multiple outcomes in each study, so we kind of categorized them in terms of these broad domains. And just to get this idea of, for every separate intervention, what do the effect sizes look like across these outcomes? But we also wanted to think about studies that don't have basic quality controls are likely to show large effects, that the quality controls kind of deflate effects. The poor quality of a study is going to inflate its effect size. It's going to lead you to overestimate, probably. And so we felt like it was important to also show if we just restrict our effect sizes to those from studies that have these basic quality controls, how does that change what we find? So we excluded single case design studies in part because you can't, so there are effect size metrics for single case design studies, but they're not really comparable to effect size metrics for group design studies. And people have said this before, but I think it's just really something to see it on the forest plot, is that there's just no behavioral summary effects available because we didn't have enough randomized control trials to actually compute a summary effect for traditional behavioral interventions. And I think that's just really compelling because it is the most commonly recommended approach in the field. And so to kind of just see that visualization of like, oh, there's no studies with just basic quality controls that are happening here in terms of group design studies is a problem. And then the next thing we restricted to was no detection bias. So the people who were measuring the outcomes or you know, assessing the participants had to be unaware of what group they were assigned to. And if they were aware, then we excluded those. And so then you can see that at that point, there's no significant effects for any intervention approach, for any outcome. And I think part of that is because a lot of the NDBI and developmental outcomes had outcomes being taken from videos of kids interacting with their parents. And so we ended up having to code those as not being fully masked because parents can actually do things in interaction videos to kind of subtly influence child behavior in a way that will inflate that score. So I think that's, you know, part of the reason that we ended up having to take a lot of the effect sizes away from the NDBI and the developmental samples. But I think in general, it still kind of holds that we have this issue with quality in terms of looking at overall percentages of studies that are, you know, kind of doing basic things, we have, you know, a lot lower than we would want for the field. So I think there's, you know, good news, and then there's also some things we need to kind of work to change.
Not only does her study highlight the lack of basic quality studies in the autism field, but it also demonstrates how research can be intentionally or unintentionally set up in a way that creates an illusion of a positive treatment effect when really there may not be one at all.
Researchers have the ability to select specific interventions and/or outcome measures that have the highest potential of producing large effect sizes. But will a treatment or intervention with a large effect size be clinically meaningful?
Not necessarily. This is where generalized versus context-bound outcomes and distal versus proximal development comes into play. So this is like words that we got to explain. Imagine I was teaching a classroom of elementary school children how to spell and read, and I want to see how two different teaching styles affect the way children perform on a spelling test. So I split the class in half, and I teach one half of the class only spelling and pronunciation of words that would be on the test. We'll call that group A. Well, I taught the other half, group B, spelling, pronunciation, grammar, and syntax rules without exposing them to the words on the test. After a month, I give the children the spelling test, and group A completely outperforms group B with an average test score of, say, 95% versus 50% respectively. So I'm wondering, well, what would happen if I give both groups a test where they had to spell novel words correctly and order them into coherent sentences? I make that test and I give it to both groups, and I find that group B is the one that scores better now, right? So the difference between the group average scores might be a little bit more modest. Maybe the group B getting 75% and group A maybe 45%.
In this example, the first spelling test represents a proximal outcome, meaning that what the intervention specifically targeted, or in this case, what Dr. Fader targeted to teach, is what was measured. While the second spelling grammar test would be more of a distal outcome, where the children would have to build on what they were taught and apply their new skills to a new context.
And this also shows the difference between generalized and context-bound learning and development. The children in group A who were taught to spell the same words that were on the first spelling test performed very well on the first test, but struggled greatly on the second test. And this shows context-bound learning and proximal effects, where a discrete skill can be applied to a specific context, but it doesn't generalize to other contexts. So group B was experiencing a more generalized learning and developmental approach, which is why they performed much better than group A on the second test, the one that required, you know, thinking about the rules that you already know, the more general rules. So the skills that group B learned improved their internal developmental sequence, which enabled them to build on their skills and apply what they learned to new contexts.
Coming back to research, though, proximal outcomes are much easier to measure because they're usually specific skills, such as spelling certain words, whereas distal outcomes are much more difficult to measure.
For these reasons, it's far easier to do research in traditional ABA approaches that teach specific skills, such as new phrases. These are narrow proximal outcomes. It's been harder to conduct research on developmental or NDBI approaches because you need to measure change across a whole domain on a validated standardized assessment administered by a naive assessor. That would be a distal effect. Proximal effects appear large, even though they may not generalize nor result in distal growth. Distal and generalized effects are more clinically meaningful, but likely they'll appear smaller in your research. And Dr. Sandbeck took this into consideration in her study.
We just looked at effect sizes across everything we compared. Do we see larger effect sizes for context-bound outcomes relative to generalized or proximal relative to distal? And what we expected was that basically if you're measuring the effect of your intervention on very specific skills within the context of intervention, it's going to show that your intervention is very, very effective. You're going to have larger effect sizes. But if you're measuring the effect of your intervention on kind of more meaningful outcomes, which are generalized across a variety of contexts and which are not exactly what you targeted in your intervention, but kind of a broader extension of it, you're going to show a lot smaller effects of your intervention. So it's going to look like your intervention is less effective. But I think when you compare, like, which of these outcomes is more meaningful, which of these outcomes is truly reflective of development in a child, regardless of what domain it is, whatever we're trying to talk about, it's a much more powerful, when I read a study that shows that ESDM, you know, facilitated changes for a group, significant changes on standardized measures of cognition or language or, you know, kind of these really, really high quality measures, I think that's a much more powerful finding than someone who showed, you know, very proximal change, you know, that they taught children to do a specific thing.
Teaching social communication may cascade into language development, not just within the intervention, but across multiple contexts.
Considering that social communication is a core challenge of autism, it's important that interventions target it and that they don't just produce proximal effects, but that they promote distal development.
I would say at present, you know, if we look at the evidence that we saw in AIM, if you're thinking about improving social communication, which is a core challenge for kids with autism. So it seems like, you know, if we're thinking about intervention, we would want to like intervene on the core challenges, right? Clearly we have higher quality evidence that developmental interventions and NDVIs facilitate improvements in social communication from randomized controlled trials. And I think that makes a lot of sense because they target it, right? Like early social communication is kind of the foundation of those interventions. And so we're actually seeing those effects. And I think at least traditional behavioral interventions are kind of coming around to trying to target social communication. But it's kind of, I think it's kind of like added on it. You can't just strip it down, you know, to these individual little behaviors and kind of teaching each one of them incrementally. You have to have a full understanding of what social communication is as you try to, you know, improve it. And I think NDVIs and developmental interventions really do that better. So yeah, I would say if we're thinking about social communication, those are going to be the approaches where we have much more high quality evidence supporting their use.
If you're familiar with the American Academy of Pediatrics AAP guidelines, you might have noticed that the research data presented by Dr. Sandbank and the AAP guidelines don't exactly line up.
The AAP guidelines suggest that the use of an Autism Diagnostic Observation Scale, the ADOS, as a chief diagnostic tool, and the results are taken to a psychiatrist, psychologist, or pediatrician who often doesn't have experience in autism, but recommends 40 hours per week of intensive behavioral interventions.
Many families hope that this will result in the best outcomes, and yet mere access to these hours is not what the research is suggesting these days. About a third of kids with autism who are preverbal at age 2 aren't likely to develop phrase speech by the end of elementary school. And this is related to effective intervention, not access to traditional ABA.
So why do the AAP guidelines recommend 40 hours a week? Why isn't it 10 or 20 hours? I mean, 40 hours a week? That's a full-time job.
Don't, you know, prescribe 40 hours per week because, you know, you heard that that's what is needed. Because we also did an analysis of intensity to see if more hours of intervention were associated with greater effect sizes. And we did this in our behavioral intervention studies and our NDVI studies and our developmental studies. And we posted that also on Open Science. And we didn't find any association between the total hours of intervention received in a study and the size of the effect. So if amount of intervention is leading to greater effect sizes, we are not seeing evidence of that. And that doesn't mean that amount doesn't matter, but I do think it means that we do not have a solid foundation for telling two-year-olds, you know, to get a job, which I think is what we're doing when we say, yeah, find 40 hours in your week to, you know, do adult-led instruction. That just doesn't seem appropriate to me. In terms of direct child intervention, I don't know. I don't know what is, you know, what is the duration that they need to be, you know, experiencing something. I just don't think we know that yet. And I think similarly with the amount per week, to learn that, we have to have randomized controlled trials where we compare intervention intensity. And actually, my advisor just completed a study like this, where they compared, it just came out this a couple weeks ago, where they compared ESDM and early intervention, or early intensive behavioral intervention. It was a randomized controlled trial. And within each group, children were randomly assigned to receive, I think it was either 15 or 25 hours per week. So they were able to compare both the interventions.
In this study, Dr. Sandbank's former advisor, Paul Yoder, compared efficacies of the Early Start Denver model, which is a form of NDBI, and a traditional ABA intervention. And he examined how different intensities of treatment, in this case, 15 versus 25 hours per week, impacted the efficacy of each intervention. And actually, there were no differences in outcomes with either the NDBI, Early Start Denver model intervention, versus the traditional ABA with either intensity. It was the first study to ask this question in this way.
And we definitely need more studies like this one, because it can be extremely taxing on a young child or a toddler to undergo 40 hours a week of traditional ABA intervention. Not to mention, it can be difficult for families to support their child through this process without seeing clinically meaningful results. As time goes on, we will gain more insight into the different interventions and treatment intensities for children with autism. It is imperative that we have high-quality, randomized control trials so that we can improve the treatment of autism with evidence-based interventions.
At this moment, the best we can do as clinicians is recommend evidence-based interventions that address the core challenges of autism. We need to inform families that we have high quality evidence that developmental interventions and NDBIs have modest to moderate effect sizes for improving social communication. But despite the thousands of studies in the literature, we just don't have the adequate quality of evidence that can be used to determine whether the traditional ABA interventions have any effect size on social communication.
It's really important that we familiarize ourselves with the different types of autism interventions, because this isn't a one-size-fits-all kind of deal. What may work for one child and family may or may not work for another, which means we have to be flexible and work with families to make sure their child is getting the best treatment they can get. We should ask families about which core challenges do they want treatment to address the most, and we need to make sure that they are aware of the different intervention options.
And before you recommend a specific intervention, figure out how to make sure that it's accessible within that particular family's community. Remember that many of these approaches are being delivered online now at a distance. Also, families may feel like they're letting their child down by not being able to fully commit to a 40-hour a week treatment plan, which is why we need to let them know that we can't say with any certainty that 40 hours a week of a traditional ABA intervention is necessary, and that they need to pursue a treatment intensity that best suits themselves and their child.
We asked Dr. Sandbank for a bottom line message to clinicians, and this is what she told us.
I think there's just got to be some humility and this kind of caution of, like, you know, we don't have the standard of evidence that we need right now. And things are getting better, and that's great. And I think standards are improving, but we have to keep going. If we want to say that a certain kind of amount of intervention is needed, we have to do those studies where we very explicitly compare those amounts. If we want to say a certain intervention is better than another kind of intervention approach, we have to actually directly compare those interventions in the randomized controlled trial. And there just isn't enough of that that's been done. And so, yeah, I mean, I don't think anyone's really in the position to be haughty. And I think when you take into account these other factors of family culture, of culture in general, of what's available, of the different, you know, the fact that autism is a spectrum and there are different profiles of ability and strengths in different kids, it's probably variable. You know, some kids are going to improve, some families are going to prefer certain kinds of interventions, and some kids are going to improve with certain kinds of interventions, and it's not uniform, right? And it just doesn't do anybody any good to be on a team, right? That's not what this is about, right? When we're on teams, we're not really achieving our goal, which is to just provide each family and child with the supports that they need. And so I think that we have to just continually remind ourselves that at the end of the day, we all need to be working to try to get kids the supports they need.
The print interview is available for subscribers to read in the Carlatt Child Psychiatry Report. Hopefully people will check it out. Subscribers get print issues in the mail and email notifications when new issues are available on the website. Subscriptions also come with full access to all the articles on the website and CME credits.
And everything from Carlatt Publishing is independently researched and produced. There's no funding from the pharmaceutical industry.
Yes, for our newsletters and books, we depend entirely on reader support. There are no ads and our authors don't receive industry funding. That helps us to bring you unbiased information that you can trust.
There are a lot of doctors and nurse practitioners listening, and quite a few students and residents too. Many of you are interested in getting some kind of CME credits for listening.
So we're going to do it. We're working on putting that program together now, and as soon as it's available, you'll be able to take a post-test for listening and get credits. Everyone who took the survey is going to get early notification when it's ready, because we have their email address. If you'd like to get that early notification, you can still take the survey at www.thecarlattreport.com/podcast survey.
As always, the links you need are in the episode description. Thanks for listening and have a great day.